to an interview with us, but he gave an interview recently in which he said his greatest fear is Marxism.
Well, we're going to leave it there. As you write in ProPublica, soon after Crow met Thomas 3 decades ago, he began lavishing the justice with gifts, including a $19,000 Bible that belonged to Frederick Douglass. Justin Elliott, we'll link to your ProPublica report, Clarence Thomas and the Billionaire. A very happy birthday to Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Tune in to democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time station manager to oversee administrative, fundraising, and business functions. Nonprofit management experience required. To apply, go to kboo.fm/station manager hire or visit our website. Deadline to apply is Friday, April 7th. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Up next, we have the Friday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an important semiconductor bill gets through the Oregon legislature.
President Biden moves to protect transgender athletes, but not completely.
And in international news, Israel bombs Lebanon and Gaza, leading to fears of escalation in the ongoing Middle Eastern conflict.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 7th, 2023. I'm Ashley Mackey.
And I'm Josh Salem. Oregon's House of Representatives just passed a bill that might help the state attract semiconductor manufacturers. With strong bipartisan support, the House gave final approval for Senate Bill 4, which tries to leverage more than $200 million in state spending into a much bigger package from the federal government. Now the bill goes to Governor Tina Kotek for her signature. Senate Bill 4 was designed to entice semiconductor companies to choose Oregon when deciding where to establish services or to expand. One part of the bill sets aside $210 million for grants and loans that companies can use to acquire and develop land for new facilities and to carry out research. The second part grants the governor unprecedented authority to shift the urban growth boundaries that restrict where development can occur around Oregon cities. Lawmakers included the provision because they apparently were concerned that Oregon lacks enough large parcels of industrial land to attract a major semiconductor facility. Lawmakers expect companies vying for those payments to also apply for some of the $52 billion the federal government is offering via the 2022 Chips and Science Act, which is an industrial strategy aimed at revitalizing domestic manufacturing, creating more reasonably paying American jobs, and strengthening American supply chains. Under the bill, Kotek has the authority to shift growth boundaries through 2024, if she determines that doing so is the only way a semiconductor project can move forward. She can make that change for up to 8 sites, 6 no larger than 500 acres, and 2 of any size.
That second provision in the bill worries farmers, conservation groups, and Republican lawmakers. In particular, the discussion has centered on protected farmland surrounding Hillsboro. Others are worried about the decision to commit more than $200 million of Oregon's limited budget at a time when the two-year budget that begins in July is not yet set. Finally, at least one representative voted against the bill because semiconductor factories consume very large amounts of power and clean water. Oregon has been a significant player in the country's semiconductor industry since the 1970s. It represents almost 15% of the national semiconductor workforce, with many jobs centered around a major Intel campus in Hillsboro. However, Oregon has also recently lost out to other states in the competition to attract major new facilities. Members of Oregon's congressional delegation invited U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo to Oregon this week. Raimondo met with U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, U.S. Representative Suzanne Bonamici, Governor Kotek, and others. Officials say of the visit, quote, "We rocked it. She was impressed," end quote. Lawmakers are trying to enhance tax subsidies that also might further lure semiconductor activity in Oregon. For example, one focus is the revival of a research and development tax credit after its former tax break lapsed in 2017. An initial proposal for that credit would grant companies up to $10 million in tax breaks for new research and development spending within the state. That proposal is felt to be more generous than similar credits offered to other states also competing for semiconductor investment.
North Dakota is trying to pass what some advocates call the most hostile anti-trans bill in the nation. Mike Moen has more on the story.
In the coming days, North Dakota's governor will decide whether to sign several bills that target transgender individuals. LGBTQ advocates say no matter what happens, they'll double down on efforts to educate the public about potential harm. The legislature has sent the governor measures that ban gender-affirming care for transgender youth, drag shows in public places, and more. Similar bills have surfaced in other Republican-led states. Barry Nelson of the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition says GOP lawmakers here are being swayed by out-of-state groups and ignoring the perspectives of constituents.
I don't believe the average North Dakotan believes in government overreach and targeting vulnerable individuals.
Nelson won't rule out legal challenges if some bills become law, but he says they'll strongly focus on engaging with people around the state about how these efforts lead to mental and physical harm, particularly to transgender youth. The governor did veto a recent bill dealing with the use of pronouns, but his position is unclear on the bills just sent to his desk. Another bill that cleared the legislature would remove transgender individuals from state data collection. Nelson says that's concerning, given that gender identity is now part of the state's Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and proposals like these could derail key research.
It provides rich data as far as how those who are non-binary and transgender are dealing with mental health and other behavioral issues in school.
Supporters of these bills claim they want to prevent inappropriate topics in schools while protecting children from medical care they might regret. But health professionals argue that gender-affirming care is vital for the well-being of some young people, and the process involves parental input. Nelson says physicians, along with members of the faith community, look to be emerging allies in their fight against these legislative efforts. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
A new proposal prevents schools, including colleges across the U.S., from enacting outright bans on transgender athletes. But teams could still limit participation in certain cases, for example, to ensure fairness. The proposed rule appears to come in response to a flood of Republican-led states seeking to ban trans athletes from competing on teams in alignment with their gender identities in school sports. A recent poll showed the majority of Americans reject anti-trans bills, but support for restriction does seem to be rising. The proposal would be a provision of Title IX, the landmark gender equity legislation enacted in 1972. It still has to undergo a lengthy approval process, and many challenges are expected. At least 16 states now have bans in effect covering high school interscholastic sports. Some also extend to intramural, club, or college sports. Enforcing the bans has been put on legal hold in at least 3 states. Under the department's proposed rule, no school which receives federal funding would be allowed to impose a policy that categorically bans trans students from playing on sports teams consistent with their gender identities.
Biden's proposal still leaves some room for schools to develop eligibility rules that could ultimately result in restrictions around trans athletes' participation. Those restrictions would be allowed only if they serve important educational objectives, such as fairness in competition or reductions in the risk of injury. Limits would have to consider the level of competition and the age of students. For example, elementary school students will generally be allowed to participate on any teams consistent with their gender identity. More competitive teams at high schools and colleges could impose those limits. Critics argue transgender athletes have an advantage over cisgender women. Last year, Leah Thomas became the first transgender woman to win an NCAA swimming title. Thomas was much less competitive when competing in men's events. Miguel Cardona, Biden's education secretary, said, quote, "Every student should be able to have the full experience of attending school in America, including participating in athletics, free from discrimination," end quote.
The Pentagon will allow Congress to review the U.S. military's withdrawal from Afghanistan, and Democrats ask Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to resign. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley in 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We called for you all to ban assault weapons, and you respond with an assault on democracy.
Tennessee State Representative Justin Jones implored fellow lawmakers to listen to the hundreds of students gathered inside the state's capitol demanding action on gun violence. Moments later, the GOP-led House voted to expel Jones for taking part in a student protest following the recent deadly shooting at a Nashville school. Lawmakers said Jones, along with fellow Democrats Gloria Johnson and Justin Pearson, brought dishonor and disorder to the chamber. The group Every Town for Gun Safety says students at more than 300 schools in 42 states walked out of classes this week calling for stricter gun laws, including middle and high school students in Portland, Oregon.
Why have you not taken action? Why do you only care that it should be your right to own a gun? Why do you not care that it should be our right to live?
Yeah!
Students say they will continue to walk out until lawmakers pass meaningful legislation. The Pentagon says it will provide Congress with documents examining the 2021 withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Veterans of the war, including Marine Sergeant Tyler Vargas, say the families of 13 American service members killed during the evacuation deserve answers.
The withdrawal was a catastrophe, in my opinion, and there was an inexcusable lack of accountability and negligence.
Documents from the White House cast blame on the Trump administration for a lack of preparation as well as a drawdown of U.S. troops prior to the withdrawal. In a 2020 documentary, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas says he prefers to travel the back roads of America.
But I come from regular stock, and I prefer that. I prefer being around that.
But documents and interviews obtained by ProPublica show Thomas accepted numerous luxury vacations around the globe for more than two decades from a prominent Republican donor and failed to disclose them. Democratic lawmakers vowed to investigate any alleged misconduct, while others called for Thomas to resign. The Supreme Court has ruled that transgender athletes in West Virginia can compete on female sports teams, at least while a lawsuit over a state ban continues. Meanwhile, schools and colleges would be forbidden from enacting outright bans on transgender athletes under a proposal released from the Biden administration, but teams could create some limits to ensure fairness. If finalized, the proposal would become a provision of the landmark gender equity law, Title IX. A report by the state of Maryland reveals more than 150 Catholic priests and others associated with the Archdiocese of Baltimore sexually abused more than 600 children over 80 years and accused church leaders of decades of cover-ups. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas accepted luxury gifts from a prominent Republican donor for more than 20 years without disclosing them, according to ProPublica, an independent public interest news service. Thomas allegedly embarked upon a series of lavish trips taken over a period of more than two decades. The trips were funded by billionaire and GOP mega-donor Harlan Crow. This disclosure is merely the latest ethics controversy dogging Thomas, who has also faced tough questions about his incomplete financial disclosure forms and appearances at other political gatherings of wealthy conservative donors. Thomas' wife, Virginia, has also come under scrutiny for her behind-the-scenes efforts to help former President Donald Trump stay in power despite losing the 2020 presidential election. The report states Thomas accepted the gifts nearly every year, including vacations on Crow's superyacht, trips on the billionaire's jet, and is a week spent each summer at Crow's private resort in the Adirondacks. ProPublica cited flight records, internal documents, and interviews with Crow's employees. Supreme Court justices do not currently have a code of ethics. Some legislators say the ProPublica story underscores why an overhaul of court ethics laws and requirements is urgently needed. The Supreme Court is the least accountable part of our government, with justices adopting personal hospitality rules and exceptions that do not compare with gift and travel rules that members of Congress have. Thomas did not respond to a request for comments, but Crow said his hospitality involving Thomas was no different from what he extended to many other dear friends. Crow also said he has never asked Thomas about any pending court cases and that he never sought to influence Justice Thomas on any legal or political issue.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, providing an in-depth report on this week's news headlines. At 7, it's Civic Cipher. Then at 8, Youth Randomonium. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 41. Tomorrow will also have cloudy skies with a high of 54. There is a small chance of rain. Today in history, in 1948, the United Nations established the World Health Organization, or WHO. In 2020, on this day, China ended its COVID-based lockdown in Wuhan. The quote of the day is from Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first black female United States Supreme Court Justice. Jackson was confirmed 1 year ago today. Jackson said, "Our children are telling me that they see now, more than ever, that here in America, anything is possible."
Israel unleashed rare airstrikes on Lebanon today, and it also bombed the Gaza Strip. The escalation sparked fears of a broader conflict after days of violence related to a sensitive holy site in Jerusalem were seen. The early morning Israeli strikes followed a very large rocket barrage fired at Israel from southern Lebanon. Experts described that attack as the most serious cross-border violence since Israel's 2006 war with Hezbollah, the Iran-backed militant group that Israel considers its most immediate threat. That violence erupted after Israeli police raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem earlier in the week, sparking outrage across the Arab world. There were no reports of serious casualties, but several residents of southern Lebanon were mildly wounded. Airstrikes hit a bridge and a power transformer and damaged an irrigation system providing water to orchards. In the Gaza Strip, Israel's military attacked what it said were weapons production sites and underground tunnels belonging to Hamas, another anti-Israel militant group. The Palestinian Health Ministry claimed the Israeli strikes damaged a children's hospital in Gaza City. The unrest comes at a delicate time, as Jerusalem is full of religious pilgrims from around the world. Christian faithful retrace the route Jesus is said to have taken for Good Friday. Jews are celebrating the week-long Passover holiday, and Muslims prayed and fasted for Ramadan. Lebanon's foreign ministry planned to submit a complaint to the UN Security Council against the, quote, deliberate Israeli bombing and aggression, end quote, which it condemned as a violation of Lebanon's sovereignty. Violence has surged recently in the West Bank, with Palestinian health officials reporting the start of 2023 to be the most deadly in two decades. Nearly 90 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire in the West Bank so far this year, mostly militants. During that same period, 16 people have been killed in Palestinian attacks on Israelis, all but one of them civilians.
Firearms are the leading cause of death for U.S. children and teens. Lawmakers in Nevada are trying to address that issue while preserving citizens' Second Amendment rights. Alex Gonzalez tells us more.
Nevada lawmakers are considering three gun safety bills. AB 354 would prohibit anyone possessing a firearm in or within 100 yards of an entrance to an election site. And AB 355 could raise the age from 18 to 21 for Nevadans to purchase an assault-style weapon. Assembly Majority Leader Sandra Howdige is a survivor of the October 1st massacre in Las Vegas in 2017. She says in the past 5 years, 6 out of the 9 deadliest shootings were committed by people under age 21, and she's championing both proposals.
These two policies are a common sense approach that I believe will protect second graders and the Second Amendment at the same time.
The third bill, SB 171, would prohibit the purchase, ownership, and possession of a firearm for anyone convicted in the last 10 years of a crime motivated by certain characteristics of the victim, such as race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation. Senator Dallas Harris says, according to the Justice Department, over 10,000 people each year are victims of hate crimes involving a firearm. As the chair of the state's first LGBTQ plus caucus, Harris says sponsoring SB 171 was a no-brainer.
The rising tide of hate and hate-motivated violence has led the FBI to elevate that type of violence to a top priority threat, singling out white supremacy as a major driver of those attacks.
The bills were discussed at a joint hearing of the Assembly and Senate Judiciary Committees Thursday. Both lawmakers are calling the bills comprehensive and common-sense gun laws and say they welcome feedback from Republicans. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Three Alaska tribes are suing the federal government to block a gold mine in southwest Alaska. But the lawsuit also affects two Alaskan Native corporations, which are partners in the project. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Three Alaska tribes are suing the federal government to block a gold mine in southwest Alaska. KNBA's Rhonda McBride has more.
The proposed Donlin Gold Mine sits near the upper reaches of the Kuskokwim, one of Alaska's two largest rivers, remote and rich with wildlife. The mine's developers say it also has the potential to be one of the biggest gold mines in the world. Opponents say the massive open pit mine that's envisioned is just too risky. Earth Justice is representing the three tribes that have filed suit, the Ohutsahagamute Native Council, the Organized Village of Kuitluk, and the Tuliksak Native Community. The suit, which was filed in U.S. District Court, challenges the final environmental impact statement for the Donlin Project. It says the mine threatens lands and waters that tribes have relied upon for food and drinking water for time immemorial. The lawsuit claims that mining tailings or spills from barges carrying toxic substances could destroy fisheries and wildlife habitat. Two Canadian companies, Barrick Gold and NovaGold, are co-owners of the mine, which pits the tribal groups against two Alaska Native corporations, which are partners in the project. The Kuskokwim Corporation owns the land, and Calista, a regional corporation, owns the mineral rights, and both have touted the mine as a golden opportunity that would bring jobs, infrastructure, and affordable energy. In a news release, Donlin Gold said that the lawsuit is without merit and is confident the decisions made by the federal agencies involved will be upheld. I'm Rhonda McBride.
An organization is examining water quality and access on tribal lands. KUNC's Emma Van Denide took a trip to the border of Arizona and New Mexico to learn more.
Let me put up yours.
Tysiana Sosi and Kimberly Ballone are standing in the dark in an office bathroom on the Navajo Nation. They're holding up plastic bags filled with water from the sink.
Mine is the first bag on top.
Oh, my bad. Ballone shines a black light on one of the bags. Sosi says that will help find contaminants.
What we're looking for is basically if it's like glowing really, really bad.
Ballone and Sosi don't think there's any E. coli, but they see some harmless bacteria in some of the numbered bag compartments.
2 and 3 on both of them are fluorescent.
I was thinking 3, and I don't think yours is.
This test is a crucial part of their Diné Household Water Survey, conducted by the Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health. It aims to learn more about water on the Navajo Nation. Estimates about water access and quality vary widely. The Indian Health Service says just over 9% of Native people lack good sanitation, but the Water and Tribes Initiative reports that number is as high as 48%. and the problem is concentrated in the arid southwest, from the Navajo Nation to the Rio Grande Pueblos.
Well, since the Rio Grande is so close to Albuquerque metropolitan area, that they're finally experiencing what we have been experiencing here.
Sosi is familiar with these water issues from her childhood.
I did live with my grandmother, and she didn't have piped or running water growing up, so we would have to, you know, use the bathroom outside.
After she and her mom moved out, Sosi got access to some running water.
It wasn't great water. It was kind of yellow, but it was still safe enough to, you know, bathe and never drank it.
Sosi hopes the survey results can highlight a vital resource their nation needs. Ballone agrees.
It is a basic thing. Everyone should be entitled to running water and all of that, but we're not here.
I'm Emma Vandenhainde.
This story is supported by the Water Desk at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A Washington state climate bill would take climate change into account when cities plan for population growth. Eric Tegedoff tells us more.
Climate resiliency could soon play a greater role in how cities in Washington plan for population growth. House Bill 1181 would update the state's Growth Management Act so that cities and counties must consider climate change in their comprehensive planning. Jamie Strobel is the climate director for the Nature Conservancy in Washington.
This would require all of those plans to take into account climate resiliency, climate change impacts, planning for those hazards, making communities safer and protected and more resilient to the impacts.
Strobel says preparing for the impact would vary between localities. Some would plan for sea level rise or managing stormwater from more precipitation, while others might plan for buffer zones in areas prone to wildfires. Opponents say it will slow the process for creating affordable housing. The legislation has passed the House and is awaiting action in the Senate. Washington State's Growth Management Act was passed in 1990. Advocates from that effort formed FutureWise after that as a watchdog group in the state. Head of FutureWise Alex Brennan says House Bill 1181 would reduce communities' dependence on cars.
Providing more housing in the places that already have that walking, biking, and transit infrastructure, that already have essential goods and services within walking distance. So creating housing options that allow more people to take advantage of those existing neighborhoods.
Strobel says the bill also emphasizes support for Washingtonians disproportionately impacted by climate change and pollution, requiring that frontline communities be included in planning processes.
This isn't a one-size-fits-all across the entire state. This is really giving jurisdictions the tools and the resources to be able to address this in their specific context in that way.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A picture book helps teach kids about the dangers of gasoline. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz tells us more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When vehicles burn fossil fuels, they create carbon pollution that warms the planet and other air pollutants that harm people's health. Kids today will inherit these problems, so Janelle London wants them to know about the risks of burning gasoline and the alternatives.
We looked and looked, and there was no children's storybook about gasoline at all. And so we decided it was time to write one.
London works for the nonprofit Cultura, which advocates for phasing out gasoline by the year 2040. She and her colleague Matthew Metz wrote Sparky's Electrifying Tale, a picture book about a boy named Rory, his sister, and his pet hamster Sparky. In the story, Rory learns where gasoline comes from and how burning it affects the climate and people's health.
The little boy becomes completely fed up with all these harms he's hearing about with gasoline and asks, is there a way to stop using this stuff?
The siblings find other ways to get around, like bikes and scooters. And with a little magic, the family's gas car turns into an electric vehicle.
Kids just get it. Kids come away from this book totally understanding what the deal is and why we need to stop using gasoline. So we've been extremely pleased with the response from this book.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 7th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Anthony Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ashley Mackey.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. KBOO News extends its thanks to my co-anchor, Ashley Mackey, who is leaving us for green, if not greener, pastures. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, former President Donald Trump was arrested this week, and we are going to talk about that. Right now, corporate news media seem to be doing what corporate news media do, employing an idea of balance that suggests that the rule of law is maybe up for debate, or maybe it's even just a stick to poke Republicans with. And who's to say what's a crime anyway? Well, we're going to talk about that in the future, but this week we want to talk about another kind of crime, the slow, steady,